Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is Green against UPS of America. Mr. Clark.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is not the typical contract interpretation case where both sides are arguing differing interpretations of a contract, and this court is called to determine which side has the better interpretation. This is a case where the court is called to evaluate the reasonableness of the plan administrator's interpretation, to determine whether the interpretation is so unreasonable that it can be called arbitrary and capricious. The plan has interpreted the share equally and current collective bargaining agreement language to allow it to collect an additional contribution from the local 705 retirees without also collecting that contribution from the IBT retirees subject to the National Master Agreement.
So, Mr. Clark, can you explain to me why in your brief you didn't really spend any time focusing on, I think, what one of the key points the district court judge made, which was that this language the sentence doesn't end after the words the $6,250 maximum. It says we'll share equally in the cost above the $6,250 maximum by making an additional contribution. And it's those last few words that I think the district court was incorporating, because there they are in the SPD, in coming to the decision it did.
Sure, I can address that. The share equally language, the by making additional contribution, share equally refers to the fact that all retirees are going to share equally in those excess costs.
By making an additional contribution.
That refers to the vehicle by which that payment will be made. The only other mention of payment in that entire additional contribution provision is the $50 per month additional contribution that is due each month.
I don't understand what you're saying. I mean, each person will share equally in the cost above by making an additional contribution. So if some people are not making an additional contribution and others are, how is that equal?
Each retiree is sharing equally in those costs in excess of the cap. Each retiree...
But not by they're not sharing, in your view, by making an additional contribution. They're sharing in some hypothetical sense.
Our interpretation is that by making an additional contribution solely talks about the method by which each retiree's share of those excess costs will be paid in to the plan by making an additional contribution. It does not say by making the same additional contribution. It does not say by making an additional contribution and collecting from each retiree or none at all. It doesn't say to collect equally from every retiree. And our interpretation...
Well, the issue is whether it refers to the collection or the computation. Isn't that correct?
Sharing equally refers to the computation, the by making...
Well, that's your position, yeah. But okay. You haven't really given a reason why there's this other language about collection.
There would be, without the by making additional contribution language, there would be no language saying how this money is paid by the retirees. There would be nothing in there saying that at all. By making an additional contribution is the vehicle by which they make this payment. And in interpreting the standard, the plan administrator's interpretation must stand as long as it is based on a reasonable explanation of relevant plan documents, or stated another way, the interpretation can only be overridden if it is without any reasonable basis or contrary to plain and unambiguous language.
That's very well established law, which I'm certain that Judge Cannelli is quite aware of. He recites it in his own opinion, but one way in which something could be arbitrary and capricious is if the interpretation of the plan administrator goes flatly against the language of the plan.
Well, we would submit that it does not plainly and unambiguously say to collect equally anywhere in it, and we would also say that it's unreasonable to interpret it that way in light of the background context facts that were well known by the plan administrator.
I don't see any of the problems. I mean, you have kind of these parades of horribles in your brief, but I think it's pretty straightforward. You've got the paragraph in the SPD that tells you what the cost per participant is, total claims divided by total numbers of participants. Then there's an amount that UPS is going to cover in this particular local, $6,250, and then whatever the difference is between that number we got from the first paragraph has to be shared equally by making, not just shared equally, period, but shared equally by making an additional payment, an additional contribution. That's what a contribution is, I assume, a payment.
Okay, first I would submit that additional contribution is being paid on behalf of the other IBT retirees by UPS.
But they're not paying it. In other words, UPS, instead of paying $6,250 for those people, is paying whatever, you know, $10,000.
But that payment is still being made on behalf of those retirees subject to a collectively bargained agreement.
So what?
They are still being each retiree throughout the nation is still only responsible for his share of that overall expense. Whether this one is an local 705 retiree is paying it and the IBT retirees are having it paid on their behalf.
I understand, but only some people are making an additional contribution.
Because
other people are not. You agree with that?
Yes, because
okay.
They collectively bargained for that, their union collectively bargained for that relief on their behalf, unlike Local 705, which did not bargain for their relief on their behalf.
But here you're blending together language from the CBA and language in the plan, aren't you?
I don't believe I am.
The same for everybody. The plan, and the plan is what we're talking about, the SPD and the underlying plan.
Yes, but the Seventh Circuit has long held in cases that you've got to look to all the plan documents, including the collective bargaining agreement. We also have to look to all the context and the background facts to understand the meaning of the term.
Well,
to the extent that the IBT, as it did here, could negotiate that $6,250 cap is negotiable, as is the ability for your retirees not to pay it. They negotiated for that relief because there is a clear divide between Local 705 and the international and the National Master Agreement. And they negotiated for that relief. Local 705 did not.
But Local 705 didn't change the SPD. The SPD remains the same for both of them. This is not like your New York State people who are under a different plan altogether.
But that plan has the exact same language.
Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but it's a different plan. So it wouldn't do violence to have that be interpreted differently.
Right, but
according to you, administrators can interpret plans any way they want to. So maybe they're interpreting the New York plan one way and they're interpreting the national plan quite a different way.
Both SPDs for those two separate plans are being, as the evidence at trial showed, are being interpreted the exact same way with the share equally. There are IBT retirees in both plans subject to the National Master Agreement who are not paying their additional contribution. Some of those are in the same plan as the New York retirees who are paying the additional contribution, same as Local 705 is here. The plan administrator's interpretation reflects the fact that there is this clear divide between the collective bargaining between the different parties. The IBT negotiated for a relief that Local 705 did not. To now, because if there's a requirement to collect equally.
But why would they know
wins?
That they need to negotiate that if there's a share equally in the cost by making a contribution language? Why is that not something they can rely on?
Because each party is subject to negotiating that separately, whether it's a $7,000 cap.
Nobody negotiated the SPD. No one changed the SPD.
Yes, but my point is you can't interpret the share equally language
by making an additional contribution. I wish you wouldn't call it the shared equally language.
The shared equally by making an additional contribution language. You cannot interpret that as crossing collective bargaining lines because as shown here, when one bargaining unit negotiates for one result and another negotiates for a different result, who wins? Who prevails? If one negotiates for a $7,000 cap and the other a $6,000 cap,
that's
what
easy.
Governs?
UPS pays up to the cap for everybody, and then the rest of the costs, as computed by the SPD, are shared equally by making additional contributions that require, you know, that are necessary to get up to that number.
Well, that reflects the fact that there is a separation between these collective bargaining agreements, which the plan administrator, relying on that separation, has interpreted that they can work out separate deals, not just different caps, but also relief from paying the excess costs.
But there's no evidence that one side said we no longer need to make a contribution. People rely on the equivalent because actually we would have to trust UPS not to think that a dollar is a dollar. UPS isn't collecting anything from the IBT people, retirees. It wants to collect from the Local 705 retirees.
It wants
and
to
so why doesn't it just load all the money onto them?
I'm sorry, I don't understand that question.
Well, why doesn't it collect a disproportionate amount of the additional cost from the local 705 retirees, since it's all completely opaque?
Because that would contradict the share equally requirement, where each retiree is only responsible for his share.
It would, but how would local 705 know that?
The plan accountings are available pursuant to any request by a participant and have been requested in this case. In the discovery in local 705, the attorneys had access to that information that showed that UPS is making that contribution. It's an entirely self-funded plan. So to the extent the cost exceeds $6,250, the money has to come from somewhere, which in this case is coming from UPS.
Is there any particular reason for the rather drastic increase in cost between the two notices?
Yes. The October 2007 SMM reflected calculations of medical costs as of a month or two prior to that. The January 2009, the 2009 calendar year is over a year later, and that was the increase in costs. The actuary testified that was the result of the increase in cost. The exact same formula.
A fourfold increase in cost?
I'm sorry?
Almost a 3 to 4-fold increase in the extra costs.
No, I believe it went up from approximately $114 to $150 for individuals.
Why did it change from a one figure to now this three-tier figure?
Because the plan administrator made the interpretation that the retirees were not really sharing equally if an individual was paying the exact same amount of those excess costs as someone with a wife or spouse or dependents who was incurring more of those additional costs. So he consulted with the actuary and made the decision to differentiate in pricing based on tiers, based on the number of participants for that retirement.
That had never been done before? It had always been just a flat contribution from each union member.
That had never been done before with this plan, as this plan currently provides for a $50 per month contribution plus this new additional contribution. So this was the first time.
I wonder if we could turn for just a moment to this issue about referencing the current CBA.
Sure.
The other part of that. I understand what the district court was thinking about when the December notice comes out and it says, you know, we're going to start collecting after the expiration of current, because as of December 2007, current is the 03 to 08 CBA for this group. But what I don't understand is UPS's argument that you're stuck in this terrible dilemma, because I don't see why you couldn't have in December 2007 said, henceforth, we're not going to use the word current at all. We're just going to amend, and we're going to refer to the 03 to 08 CBA, or we're going to refer to the 08 to 13 CBA, and we'll just, as you point out frequently in your brief, you can amend the SPD when you want to. Why not get some clarity in there? That would eliminate all possibility of argument about when you can increase, when you can start collecting these costs.
Because we didn't believe it was necessary, because we were clarifying which current collective bargaining agreement.
Clarifying at all. I mean, the word current is, you know, current events. Current events 5 years ago were not current events today, were they?
I would agree that current events change with time, but I would also submit that interpreting the term current to refer to whichever agreement is in effect at that present time effectively negates the entire additional contribution provision.
My point exactly, and it's entirely in your power to eliminate that problem by simply referring to the agreement by its full name, if you will. You know, after the expiration of the 03 to 08 CBA, we're going to start collecting the extra contributions from you. Anyone could read that anytime, any day, and they would understand exactly what that meant.
And I guess my response would be that's why that's not an incorrect interpretation of that, because it would negate the entire provision that you have with all this detail of a $6,250 cap.
Why?
That it's negotiable.
Why wouldn't it also possibly reflect the fact that UPS has decided once again to roll it over to the end of the next CBA? It sounds like that's just bargaining.
Well, then this language would be start again with the next agreement if you take that interpretation with the next.
Until you decide to change it.
You would submit that that's unreasonable to read this one sentence as negating the entire provision of collecting the additional contribution.
Is current ambiguous or unambiguous?
I believe it's unambiguous because I believe it's unreasonable to interpret current. And we've made the argument that there's a latent ambiguity as a backup argument, but I believe it's unreasonable. If you get a letter saying you owe $100 at the end of the current week, The first thing a reasonable person is going to do is going to look at the date on the letter, and they're going to then look to determine what week that refers to. Someone may sit and look at the week they receive it and make a decision on whether that is that week. But I would say it's unreasonable.
Doesn't that automatically prove what Judge Cudahy just said? If you received it on December the 7th, you'd think, well, the current week is the week that's running from the 7th to the 11th. But if you happen to be a victim of slow mail delivery and you receive that on December the 14th, you're going to think current week is a different week.
And that's exactly our point.
I don't have any idea. So why doesn't that show what Judge Cudahy just said?
Well, and that's exactly our point. Every plaintiff in this class received that language, SPD, in 2002 during the 2002 to 2008 agreement. They all received the SMM in December of 2007 when the current agreement was the 2002 to 2008. That SMM also stated that the contingency in that language, if the cap is exceeded, if the cost exceeds $6,250 and an additional contribution is necessary, then it will be collected at the expiration of this current collective bargaining agreement. It further, that again happened in 2006 and refers to the 2002 to 2008 agreement. Every relevant marker that a reader would look to determine what current meant, a reasonable reader, all refers to the 2002 to 2008 agreement. I would say it would be unreasonable for someone to put the SPD on their shelf for 7 years and then pull it out and believe that it refers to the 2008 to 2013 agreement. We would also, the evidence presented at trial, we believe supports the interpretation of current collective bargaining agreement. In evaluating the reasonableness of the plan administrator's interpretation, we have to ensure that it's consistent with plan goals. Well, as was testified at trial, the reason for this language was to give the union an opportunity to negotiate before the additional contribution was actually collected, and that occurred. The cap was exceeded in 2006. In 2008 negotiations, the National Master Agreement, the IBT, negotiated for relief from their retirees. Local 705 had the opportunity to do so, but neglected to do so. So that opportunity, the purpose of the plan, has taken place. And now we are in a new agreement where they've already had that opportunity and there's nothing preventing the collection of the additional contribution. The other evidence that was submitted is, again, the consistent interpretation. This very same plan administrator is not making a determination on this language means one thing in one instance and another thing in another instance. He is interpreting the exact same language in the New York plan to refer to the 2002 to 2008 agreement and is collecting from those New York retirees as soon as their contract expired in 2008.
I'm just going to remind you, you're in your rebuttal time if you want to save any, but it's okay. Yours to use.
If it pleases the court, I will defer to my rebuttal time.
Okay. Mr. Gilbert.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Jeffrey Gilbert, and together with Stephen Rosenblatt and Patrick Ryan, we represent the plaintiff class, who are the appellees and the cross-appellants.
Can you just tell me why the local 75 negotiates its own collective bargaining agreement here?
Yes, it's a large local. Chicago is a hub. It has bargaining power that other locals might not have, and it wants to use that bargaining power. So it feels like it can get a better agreement. And it's not the only local that does that.
It usually comes out ahead, but apparently it didn't in this case.
Well, they had every reason to believe in this case that they came out exactly the same, as I think the questioning indicated. The language of the SPD wasn't going to change. It was incorporated by reference through the collective bargaining agreement. So they had every reason to think that this was just not going to be a change at all. There was no change in the language. It was only when the new notice came out after the new collective bargaining agreement had been reached that suddenly UPS was saying, we are going to change it, even though they just agreed again to make it the same language.
Is there a conflict between the non-Local 75 union members and the international members on this issue?
No, actually, not between, if I understand your question correctly, non-705 members are generally represented by the IBT. There is actually one other local, Local 710, which negotiates its own agreement. So putting them aside for a moment, it's the IBT that's negotiating on behalf of everybody other than the non, other than the local 705 and local 710 people.
But the members of the international who are not in local 75 or one or two of these other local
right.
unions, that do they potentially face greater contributions if you're successful in this?
No, because the record shows, and counsel just indicated, that the IBT agreed with UPS that there would be no increase during the term of the 2008-2013 collective bargaining agreement.
The current.
Yes, what we would call the
not
current one.
Not
current,
that right. bad word.
Right. Well, I like the word, actually, but yes. So they would have no reason to think that, that UPS isn't going to honor that agreement. And UPS has never threatened to do so that I'm aware of.
So is it your concept that UPS right now is, quote-unquote, paying for the additional contribution for the IBT retirees, but since this is a self-funded plan, if we were to affirm the district court on this aspect of things, UPS, in effect, would be paying the additional contribution for the 705 retirees as well?
Yes, I think that's fair to say. I mean,
out of one pocket and putting it in the other, perhaps, but
yes, the way I
absorbing
it.
Yes,
the way I would put it is the others aren't making a contribution, and therefore the 705 members ought not to have to make a contribution to pay the excess costs either, because the language is that everybody will make the shared equal contribution if there's going to be any contribution at all.
And so the rest of it's just internal accounting for UPS.
Yes, that's essentially right.
How much, if everybody's included, how much does that bring all these costs down? Which I think Judge Cudahy asked about these significant increases, which were pretty significant.
Yeah, they were significant.
Sevenfold for just a spouse and a retiree.
You mean how much does it bring it down for each person?
Yeah.
It depends, of course, whether you're an individual or you're paying for
it. Yeah, I said
I think it was.
I don't think there's too many retirees that have dependents, but put them aside for a minute.
Yes.
Typical retiree and a spouse. They went from $50 to $350.
Yeah, $310 if I remember correctly, but I'm remembering off the top of my head, so I could be wrong about that. So but yes.
What does that number come out to if everybody's included?
I'd have to do the math, and I don't remember the number of total people in the plan, but I can calculate that for you and get it to you. I don't want to guess just because I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I'm not sure. It's not...
You don't know, in other words, how many local 705 retirees we're talking about in this B2 class?
Yeah, actually, we do. There were about 1,000, if I remember correctly, and I'll get that number exactly for you. But there was no dispute about numerosity. If I remember correctly, it was 960. Now, it varies.
Close enough. Yeah.
Yes, it varies, of course, over time because people retire and people pass away. So, the one thing I wanted to note is that what's been called the share equally language actually has three components to it. One is everybody must share. Two is the sharing must be equal, and three is that the sharing has to be done by making a contribution. And UPS would have to comply with all three of those requirements in order to meet the language of the plan.
Now, of course, UPS does make the point, which suggests that perfect equality is not going to happen, because I guess some people have a $6,250 cap for the, I guess, the first tranche that UPS covers for people, and maybe somebody else has a $7,000 or a $6,000. So what happens then?
Well, those are separate plans, so I don't know whether it's appropriate to talk about equality from one plan to another.
They're all different plans numbers.
Within this plan, the number is $6,250, and then everybody would have to share equally above those.
So if the number you got by dividing total claims by total number of participants turned out to be $7,250 for a particular year, just use an easy number, you know,
yes.
then everybody would have to chip in $1,000 if they're collecting from anybody.
Yes, if they're collecting from anybody and if they're collecting 100% of the excess costs.
Mm-hmm.
There could then be negotiation about are you going to collect 100% or 80% or 20%.
So why didn't Local 708 negotiate this?
Because they had actually, I don't think it's fair to say that they didn't. They specifically asked at the table, and this is in the record, whether or not the SPD was going to change, and they were told no, it wasn't. They understood, quite reasonably, I think, we're agreeing again to another collective bargaining agreement that's going to contain exactly the same language because it's incorporating the SPD, which has not been changed. Therefore, we are acquiring the same language again. There's nothing to negotiate unless 705 had said for some reason they wanted to try and get a better deal on behalf of the retirees. But they didn't take that position. They didn't ask for anything more, thinking, quite reasonably, that it was going to stay exactly where it was and satisfied that that was an acceptable resolution.
Well, the whole issue is whether this making additional contribution language is talking about computation or is talking about collection.
Yes, that's the way UPS frames it, but I don't see how it can be anything else but a question of collection.
I don't think there's any ambiguity about it.
No, I don't think there is. As Judge Canelli pointed out, the prior language in the sentence before describes how the contribution is figured, how the amounts are figured. The next sentence, the one that we're all focused on, is the one that talks about how you will go about acquiring that money or not acquiring it if the circumstance of the excess cost comes to pass, that is the amount over $6,250. And that says, here's how you'll get the money. Everybody will share equally, and everybody will make a contribution. I don't think you can say that someone is making a contribution to UPS to pay for those excess costs when UPS says, don't pay us anything, we'll pay it for you. That's not to make a contribution. Indeed, if that interpretation was correct, it would take all the meaning out of the language altogether, because the language might just as well have said, UPS can collect any amount from any subset it wants to, and it would have gotten itself into exactly the same place. Well, if both those languages lead to exactly the same result, then there's no meaning to the first language, which was quite specific. Everyone will share equally, everyone will make a contribution. If the people in this room are all going to make a contribution, it can't be that some of them don't pay. They're not making a contribution. And I would emphasize that the standard looks to the question of what a reasonable participant would understand.
Yeah, well, that's where you and UPS have a bit of a debate, because UPS says it's really all what the administrator thinks the language means, and you're coming back and saying, no, it's, you know, there's kind of the reasonable reader or participant or reasonable somebody.
Yes, but I don't really think there is a dispute, because while the standard says that they have to act arbitrarily in order for a court to reverse them, one question about whether they're being arbitrary is whether they're interpreting it, as you said, in a way that's contrary to the language, or to put it, I think, essentially the same way, but with a slightly different idea on it that Congress gave in the statute, in a way that wouldn't be understood by a reasonable participant. I'm not sure there's any reason to think a reasonable participant would understand it any different than any other reasonable person. But the point being that if a reasonable participant would not understand the language the way they're interpreting it, that's a pretty strong suggestion that they're acting arbitrarily. And the standard does have some teeth. Obviously, it's looser than other forms of review, like de novo review. We couldn't possibly dispute that. But it's not a failure to review at all. So if it constitutes an arbitrary interpretation to say that share equally by all the group means somebody doesn't have to pay, if that's something that no reasonable person would understand and that makes it arbitrary, then it violates the standard however you put it. And I think that's exactly what went on here, is that it's just contrary to the language that's right there in front of them.
Suppose a wife makes a contribution instead of a retiree. Does that mean that everybody hasn't contributed equally?
No, because it doesn't matter where the retiree gets the resources to make the contribution. He has to get it from whatever resources he or she has. That includes a gift that might be made by somebody else. That's part of the resources you acquire. But that's different than saying that UPS itself makes the contribution. If UPS makes the contribution, then no contribution is being made, because to make a contribution to oneself is to simply to forgive the debt, to forgive the obligation. That's different than saying that when I get a Christmas gift of, say, $50 and put it in my bank account and then write a check, I'm failing to make a contribution because I'm using in part the Christmas gift. I mean, that's my money. It was given to me. And so I don't think that the fact that somebody else, a third party, helps the person pay makes any difference.
At one point in your brief, you argue that, well, the retirees didn't negotiate this contract. The union did. Isn't that right?
Yes.
That argument. Of course, that's true of all retirees don't have any vote in the union anymore, but they're the third-party beneficiary of the contract.
That's right. They are
whatever the union wants to give them. That's basically what it's all about.
Right, but once there has been a negotiation and they have gotten whatever it is that the package entails, they're then, I think, entitled to rely on that. What UPS was arguing is that somehow a burden falls on 705 because it failed to do something. Well, as I've said, I don't think it really failed to do anything. It asked the relevant question, are you going to change the summary plan description? They said no, and it relied on that. But in any event, a failure on behalf of the local can't be borne by the retirees if the language is such that the interpretation that UPS would give to it is arbitrary because it's contrary to that language. They got the benefit of whatever bargain was struck, and in deciding what that is, you look to the language.
The retirees are at the mercy of the union, basically.
Yeah, well, in this case, I don't think they were at the mercy of the union. I think the union got what understood that they had achieved for the retirees, exactly what they'd achieved before, precisely the same language that they'd been using, which was acceptable to the union. I mean, obviously, there may have been somebody who wished they'd gotten an even better deal, but that's always the case, of course. There could be such people. The union made a decision, given what we understand, and I think reasonably understand we're getting, this is acceptable.
So I want to get to the bottom of your cross-appeal, and as I understand it, your real criticism of the December 2007 SSM is that it somehow wasn't detailed enough.
Yes, the regulations require that there be some specificity about how much a person's going to have to pay, and there was none.
But why isn't this, I mean, it alerts people to the fact that UPS's act so far of picking up the extra cost is going to stop at the end of the collective bargaining agreement that for 705 ends on July 31st, 2008.
Right, but then there's an intervening event. They negotiate another contract, and they don't change the language, and they've never increased the amount that's paid by any specific amount. So it was perfectly reasonable for people to think at that stage in the game the new contract becomes the current contract. That is, after all,
they think in December 2007 that they're somehow at risk for having to pay more, but then when the 2008 contract comes in, they say, you know,
exactly,
this is not going to happen.
Because that's exactly the road that they were led down. That is, if you look at the regulation, what it essentially says is that part of the fiduciary duty is to be forthright, is to say, not just we're going to increase it, but here's how much, right?
But how can the union do that? I mean, presumably they're using the past calendar year. You know, I'm not sure under your view it's ever possible to be specific enough.
Oh, I think it is, because all they would have to do is adopt the language of the relevant documents. That is, let's suppose that in the negotiation, the UPS started out saying we're going to raise it by $100, right? They negotiated, they agree to $70, let's suppose. All they would have to do is say, in, for instance, the collective bargaining, for some period of time, let's say 45 days, after the ratification of the new collective bargaining agreement, UPS can change the amount by no more than $70. UPS then does that. It issues an SPD, an SMM, I'm saying, increasing it by that amount. They accomplished the goal. And whatever you imagine the negotiation might have been, suppose it would have been that they could raise it twice during the term of the agreement, once within 45 days after ratification, and another time within 45 days after the first of some year. Okay, then you embody that in the documents. All that was required of UPS was to be forthright about what it wanted to do and allow the union to negotiate given that forthright understanding of what UPS wanted. It, of course, could have come to the table and said, we're raising it $100, and we're not budging off that, and we don't care how long you go on strike, if that's what they had wanted to do. But presumably there would have been negotiation, they would have reached a resolution in the end, and then they would have embodied it in a document. It's not surprising that the fiduciary duty puts a burden on UPS to be forthright.
But the regulations don't seem to say you've got to get it down to the dollars and cents.
No, I think it says, though, that you have to be able to make a contribution. It doesn't say you have to tell John Smith that he will pay exactly this amount. But you have to tell him that people in a certain group, of which he either is or isn't, are going to have it raised, let's say, X percent, right?
Where do you get that, though? I mean, I don't see that much specificity in the regulations. There's a reference to premiums, but there are formulas already in this SPD. You know, people are told how these numbers are going to be computed.
It says you have to describe the method by which the amount of contribution is calculated.
Right.
That I'm quoting. And then it says it shall include a description of any cost-sharing provisions, including premiums, for which the participant or beneficiary will be responsible.
So why doesn't this SPD describe cost-sharing and the way premiums are going to be handled?
It doesn't tell them, and this is the language, how the amount of the contribution is going to be calculated.
Assuming it doesn't technically make the grade as an amendment, isn't it perfectly good as extrinsic evidence of what was intended here?
Well, but the problem, of course, is that, first, there's a question about whether there's any basis for introducing extrinsic evidence at all. But apart from that, it's all one-sided. That is, that UPS might have understood that was what it was doing. Wouldn't have given anybody else an ability to understand that because they came along and negotiated the contract again, incorporating again the term current collective bargaining agreement at exactly the moment when the calendar is changing from last week to this week. Now, of course, the current collective bargaining agreement is the new one because that's what it means to be current, the one that's in effect now. And the term isn't ambiguous because of that. Obviously, you don't know the referent until you know the referent. That is, I don't know that today means December 7th until I look at a calendar and say, oh, that's right, it's the 7th. But that doesn't mean I don't know what the word today means. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further?
If I can, I would like to clarify my response to one question earlier. I was asked, is the term current ambiguous? And I apologize. I absolutely agree that it's not plain and unambiguous, contrary to how the plan administrator interpreted the plan. And I believe it would be unreasonable to interpret it in any other way other than how the plan administrators interpreted it. But as we've argued with our extrinsic evidence argument, we do believe it is at very least a latent ambiguity, if not an ambiguous term in that regard to that agreement. And I would also like to address what the district court correctly noted was kind of a catch-22 under plaintiff's argument.
Could I, rather than that, I mean, I wonder if you could just spell out in about 10 words what the difference is between the injunction that the district court actually entered and the one that your opponents would like. What do you lose by going down the path of the cross appeal?
To the extent that there's a term set for until July 2013, and there's a suggestion that we no longer have the right to amend these terms prior to July 2013.
So you see, the plaintiffs is essentially trying to freeze you into the current
allocation
of how much UPS pays, how much other. Even if you were to lose on the additional contribution point, you'd still have the right, under your view, to amend.
Correct. Okay. And Judge Cannelli noted, I thought, as much in his opinion. If I could make one other point on the share equally argument with regard to the argument that everyone must at least make some additional contribution if it's different. If Local 705 had negotiated for a $9,000 cap and the expenses this year were $8,000 and the IBT negotiated for a $7,000 cap, only the IBT retirees would be making an additional contribution.
How could the Local 705 have gotten the $9,000 cap without changing the plan as opposed to the collective bargaining agreement?
If there were no separate caps negotiated, I would assume that there would have to be, the SPD would have to be amended to reflect those different amounts.
That's the point. And they assured themselves that the SPD, in fact, was not going to be changed.
I guess our point is that the interpretation of share equally reflects that is a reality with those separate collective bargaining agreements, that they can do that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.